This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom as she joins us to talk about chocolate. And why are we talking about chocolate? It is because it is day two of our short and sweet member drive. I am in studio with Main Street's Craig Blumenschein. Craig, thanks for being on the show.
Ashley, you bet. It's great to be here, and chocolate is the theme of the day.
Absolutely. 800-359-4145. If you're like me and you think that chocolate should be the theme of every day, advantage of our special thank you gift during this short and sweet member drive, which is a 1 pound box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry when you come in at $10 a month. 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org.
But there's more, Ashley. For members who contribute today, they'll automatically be entered into our ultimate date night drawing to win 2 nights at the Hotel Donaldson, a $100 gift card to the Blarney Stone at the Hotel Donaldson, and a pair of tickets to the FM Symphony's A Night at the Oscars concert. That's on February 25th. The prize really will be a great weekend giveaway, even if you live right here in Fargo. The Hotel Donaldson is a boutique hotel located in downtown Fargo, only blocks from the Fargo Theater, where you could walk the red carpet for the symphony's Oscar concert. Everyone who gives a gift, like Ashley said during the short and sweet drive, will be entered to win and receive that chocolate, those chocolate truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastries. Ashley, right now is the best time to call. 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org. And no contribution is necessary to enter into that drawing for the Hotel Donaldson giveaway.
But we certainly do hope that you will make a contribution. So what are we talking about if you are a new listener? Perhaps you've noticed we're not doing commercials, which, by the way, make a lot of money for commercial stations. Instead, what we do is look to you, our listener, to help fill in those gaps, because instead of making money selling commercials, we fill our time with programming, with more content. And so we ask our listeners to help support us, and we say thanks. And in this case, we say thanks with a 1 pound box of cocoa truffles. She has been doing this for 20 years. She knows what she is doing. And we will send them to you or to the Valentine of your choice when you call 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org.
And joining us now is Dr. Stefan Weiler. Dr. Weiler is professor of economics at Colorado State University and director of the Regional Economic Institute. Dr. Weiler, welcome to Main Street.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
The topic today and the topic that we have all been hearing about is inflation. But you've written an article that relative to inflation, a disproportionate burden is being shouldered by rural Americans. In fact, your article in The Conversation was titled, "Rural Americans Aren't Included in Inflation Figures, and for them, the cost of living may be rising faster." What have you found about inflation and what we should know about here in rural America?
It's an oversight that I'm actually that we noticed already while I was working at the Federal Reserve, almost 20 years ago. It is true that all the inflation measures, both the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, as well as the Personal Consumption Expenditure Index, which is the Fed's favorite inflation figure, both are based on urban prices. And as folks know, particularly in our states, which have a significant rural component, prices and price growth differ a lot. And part of that is just, for example, it takes more money to get a good out to a rural area than it does to get to a city. I mean, one of the advantages of cities is that they're clusters. So, a whole set of trucks can easily make deliveries on a given morning, whereas the same trucks would have to fan out over North Dakota or Colorado to make deliveries. So right there, they've decided not to make rural part of the equation, and that's ignoring about 14% of the population. and disproportionately part of the population that is significantly economically disadvantaged. I mean, there are plenty of success stories in rural America, but rural America generally is more challenged in terms of income. And so it's much more sensitive to the rate of inflation. I mean, prices going up will take a bigger chunk out of rural income simply because they're smaller.
You're right, Dr. Weiler, that simply it just costs more to run a car in a rural area. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. And certainly with the price of gasoline that we've all thought about, certainly in the last couple of years for sure, that adds to what's coming out of our bank account.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's really, in some ways, that's the distance, the transportation is kind of the root cause of all of this. I mean, that things are further away, everything from doctors to childcare, to, you know, your local construction contractor, even. These things are all tend to be clustered in urban areas. Again, it makes sense. You have a larger market all in one place. But that still leaves out people in rural areas who, you know, for example, have to travel hours. I'm sure people know this from personal experience. And if you want a specialist, not just a general practitioner, but a specialist doctor, you may be traveling for hours. We have Fort Collins is in the northern part of Colorado, and our orthopedic center, you see license plates from South Dakota. So, I mean, when you think about that distance of needing to go from South Dakota to Colorado just to get, for example, you know, your shoulder replaced or something, you know, that makes a really big difference.
Not only the cost of transportation, of course, but then food and lodging and all of those things are factored in. You wrote that the average distance that a rural American travels to a grocery store is 3.11 miles. I wish that my grocery store was that close.
Absolutely. I mean, that's an average. So keep in mind that that's just the, you know, there are some small towns that have grocery stores, but generally food deserts are a real fact of life in rural America. And so you're right. I mean, some people have to make big shopping trips, you know, once every 2 weeks or once every month, depending on how far the closest grocery store is. So 3.11 is just an average. I think more significantly, it's basically four or five times the distance that that urban residents need to make in order to find groceries.
Dr. Weiler, you do talk about the cost of homes, and in fact, the cost of homes may be a bit cheaper for those of us in rural America than those in urban areas. Yet still, inflation overall would be more of a burden for us. Where does the cost of homes and housing factor into what you talk about?
The cost of homes, it's an interesting question. You're right that in general, rural housing is less expensive. Unfortunately, it's also older. It is comprised sometimes, you know, of modules or trailers or those sorts of things. And in general, the housing stock in rural areas, relative to urban areas, is significantly older and more dilapidated. And what that means is that both heating and cooling costs, and I mean, you know, I can only imagine what you folks in Fargo see as heating bills. That makes
I'll throw
a huge
it in there.
Difference.
It's not as bad as I thought it would be. But
oh, really?
it isn't cheap either.
Yeah. So in some sense, yes, the housing is somewhat cheaper, but you are more sensitive to your changes in price of fuel oil, for instance, propane or electricity, all of which have been bouncing around a whole bunch, and that makes it very hard. I mean, another problem with rural areas is it makes it very hard to budget when prices change so frequently. You're trying to maintain a good budget with your household, but then all of a sudden, you know, eggs, you know, jump by a dollar. That makes a real difference.
Why is it that rural Americans are not surveyed relative to the consumer price index? Is this a philosophical choice? Is this something that is intentionally excluded? Or the fact that, you know, 14% of Americans live in that area, so let's just worry about where most Americans live?
You know, it's a good question. And for having studied rural sites and states, my dissertation was actually on West Virginia and the Appalachians. I think the oversight is one, convenience. It's much harder to survey a widely spread audience. You have to incur more transport costs. So we're back to transport costs. And I think the other thing is that rural areas are tough because it's hard to categorize them in any one simple way. And I'll take Colorado as an example. We, as most people know, there's two parts to the state. There's the mountain part of the state, which covers about the 2/3 of the western part of the state, and 1/3 that is basically an extension of Kansas. It's basically soy and corn fields. And the price differentials between those and the inflation differential between those types of rural areas is extreme. So I think part of it is cost. Part of it is that rural is simply more complicated than urban. I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to, that even if you try to do a rural index for Colorado, you know that Aspen is going to be different than, you know, say, Lamar, which is a town close to the Kansas border. So even trying to do a rural price indicator would be difficult. So I think they just earn, and the census is not overflowing with money. They've had to make some tough choices, and this is one of the tough choices that they've had to make.
The Federal Reserve just concluded its meetings this week and voted to lift interest rates again by another 0.25 percentage point, marking, mm-hmm. I think, the 8th increase. What did you learn from their meetings?
I think what I learned is that they themselves are seeing sort of the whites of the eyes of disinflation, that they can actually now see that the disinflationary process is going. What does that disinflation mean? It basically means that prices are reversing, that they're going up by less. If people will remember, we were up in the 9% in June, almost to 10%, and now we're down to 6.5% in the CPI. So that's a fairly significant drop. Consumers are spending a little less and saving a little more. So they think that tougher times are ahead. So that's cutting, you know, savings for a rainy day, make a difference as well. The 25 basis points itself was widely expected, but they made clear that they were probably going to do, one to two more rate increases. They'd like to see the interest rates probably at around 5% by year's end, but they're now much more sensitive to the data coming in. And the data coming in suggests that, in fact, prices are beginning to moderate, in some cases are coming down, and that they're taking that into account. And so they made a relatively small increase. It's not the increase itself, but relative to the three quarter or 75 basis point increases that happened all through last year, 25 basis points is relatively small. And their monetary policy operates with a lag, which means when they change interest rates, activity doesn't immediately change. It kind of has to filter its way through the system. And so they understand that, and they're willing to wait to see what the inflation numbers tell them in the coming months.
So we've learned that the U.S. economy has now is growing at an annual rate of 2.9%, at least from the most recent statistics that I have seen from the fourth quarter of last year.
Right.
Give us your comments on this narrow path we're starting to hear about whether our country will fall into a recession, whether it may be a light recession, or if we can thread the needle and avoid a recession altogether. I know there's many, many factors involved in what will happen in the near future, in the short term, through the end of the year and longer than that. But what are you thinking today relative to whether we may be looking still at a recession in 2023?
I think that the chances of what you call a soft landing, in other words, reducing inflation without causing a recession, I think the odds of that are going up. I may be an optimist, but I think the odds are almost even that we do get away with reducing inflation and not seeing a recession. Or if we do see a recession, it's going to be a relatively mild, short one. I was saying this a few months ago, and that was considered very optimistic. Now it's become, I think, more of a centrist view that the Fed seems to be threading the needle relatively well. And the inflation's coming down. Job growth, which we can talk about later too, job growth remains strong. People are finding jobs. Job openings are hit a record. There's now 2 job openings for every unemployed person there is in the United States. So all these are signals that the economy itself is doing relatively okay. 2.9 would be considered sort of average for the 2.9 GDP growth would be considered sort of average during any normal year. But the fact is that that normality is exactly why people are getting a little more hopeful that we may avoid a recession.
Do you subscribe to this theory that unemployment has to go above X? It has to go. We need to have unemployment rise in order to understand whether our policy is good.
I don't think so. And unemployment itself is not always a great indicator, because what it doesn't tell you is people that are participating in the labor force. And people participating in the labor force are either the ones employed, obviously, but also the ones that are unemployed but looking for jobs. And there's a substantial portion, particularly in my age group of the mid-50s to mid-60s, that have reduced their labor force participation. And so there are people waiting on the sidelines to see whether they want to get back into the job market. So in that sense, the economic conditions, again, as we were talking about, are relatively good. We're at a record low unemployment rate, and we still have reserve workers out there that could come back into the labor market if it looks strong enough.
I want to turn back to the housing market, because the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage rate fell to 6.09% this week. Mm-hmm. My first mortgage was 11.2%. That tells you when we bought our first home.
That's very much.
And yeah. Where do you think interest rates are heading, even though Fed is still raising base rates? Interest rates are falling here just a little bit. And most people really view that housing is the place to watch whether we're mm-hmm. going to into a recession or not.
Right. The mortgage rates are tied mostly to not to the federal funds rate, which is what the Fed sets, but the 10-year bond, which is what's called the long bond. Basically how much money do people want, the return that people want for waiting 10 years to get their money back. That's effectively what a bond is. And so, housing itself is relatively steady. There hasn't been any major changes in most states' construction rates. I mean, your case of Fargo and Western North Dakota is interesting, and I'd like to sort of hear more about what's going on there. But housing, in that sense, if anything, for various reasons, and partially part of it being price inflation in urban areas, they're actually looking for more housing. Places like San Francisco, Los Angeles are looking for more housing because housing price inflation has been going up so much. But it does seem to be moderating. The supply versus demand, I couldn't go through a whole conversation as an economist without those two magic words, obviously. the supply and demand of housing is actually matching up a little bit better. So all of the big cities are actually moderating their price growth. And in rural areas, it's been roughly steady. I see the mortgage rates staying in the 6-7% range, largely because I think that 10-year bond reflects a confidence in the Fed of keeping the ship afloat without letting it sink. And I think that is becoming more realistic. That means that the 10-year bond yield, which is roughly reflects the mortgage rates, is in pretty good shape. And so I don't think there's going to be any huge increase in mortgage rates anymore.
Dr. Weiler, you also monitor, I think, personal savings rates, and those are falling. Mm-hmm. People are not saving at the rate that they were a year ago.
In the pandemic.
Yeah, and we all got a lot of free money in the pandemic. We weren't going out, traveling. Transportation was not as expensive, and gas was much less expensive then, too. But relative to what you're seeing with credit card balances, which are rising, mm-hmm. personal savings rate, 3.4%, falling. How concerning is that to you?
I think a year ago was exceptionally high savings rate because they couldn't spend because of the lingering effects of the pandemic. So when you're comparing it to a high relative number a year ago, it does seem that it's relatively low. But the most recent report shows that consumer saving is actually going up. It's signaling that consumers are becoming slightly more cautious and that they're keeping their spending in check as well.
What about credit card balances? How does that concern you, or does it at all?
Credit card balances always concern me, given the, this is editorial, but extortionarily high rates. Those credit card charges get really, really large, really fast at the percentages that they are. And so, yes, that's the kind of debt that worries me. Mortgage debt worries me less because you're gaining equity in a household. That's something. But credit card purchases are generally meant for non-durable goods. So it's not like you're investing your money. You're basically spending it. And repaying it can be a real challenge for most people. The minimum payment is always so beguiling in the sense that, well, all I really need to pay is $20 or $30. That's why they force the credit card companies to show on your statements how long it would take to pay off your credit card if you only had, you only paid the minimum. So yes, credit card debt is actually, I consider most, one of the most sort of inflammatory pieces of debt that you can own.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Stefan Weiler, professor of economics at Colorado State University, who makes the argument that inflation is worse for rural Americans than it is urban Americans. We have about a minute left, Dr. Weiler. Overall, let's come up in that plane with me at 30,000 feet.
Right.
We've talked today about the twin threats of inflation and recession. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that maybe things are going to land okay. What should we as consumers be looking out for in the next, say, let's say, 6 months to really get our guidepost? What should be most concerning to us as we're looking here into the next part of the year?
I think the next part of the year, the interesting things are going to be the job market and inflation. If inflation keeps falling, the chances of the Federal Reserve continuing rate hikes to cool the economy, their incentive to do that will go down. And so keeping an eye on the inflation rates, I think, is really important. The other thing that's important, just because jobs are kind of crucial basically to people's well-being, is to keep an eye on the labor market. One of the things that the labor market has been doing has been churning out a couple hundred thousand jobs. They've been slowly declining as the Fed would like, but that indicates that the Fed is indeed looking towards a soft landing where you still have hiring despite the fact that the Fed has higher rates. And so, you know, the labor market and inflation are the two things that I would follow. And we'll actually get numbers on the January jobs tomorrow morning. And we'll see, people are predicting something under 200,000 in a continued cooling labor market. And I think that's about right.
Dr. Stefan Weiler, professor of economics at Colorado State University and director of the Regional Economic Institute. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure visiting with you on Main Street.
I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. Thanks again.
Still to come on Main Street, an essay from Tom Ezern and chocolate, of course, with Sue Balcom. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A representative of the North Dakota Secretary of State's office is suggesting a legislative study of the state's campaign disclosure laws, as well as other voting laws. Leanne Oliver is with the Elections Division. She told the Senate State and Local Government Committee her office is tracking 41 election-related bills, 11 of them dealing with campaign finance.
Due to the numerous bills this session that examine campaign finance laws, we would encourage the Legislative Assembly to consider an interim study to look at North Dakota's campaign finance laws and systems. If all of these were passed, it would create a ball of wires within the Sentry Code as well as our system that would be impossible to enforce and burden to implement with our technology.
Oliver's comments came during a hearing on a bill that would have established new disclosure requirements for advocacy committees, such as the Brighter Future Fund. That bill's primary sponsor, Hazleton Republican Senator Jeff Megrim, was asked if he would consent to amending his bill to call for a study.
I hesitate to change these bills to a study because we know from past history that they choose out of a basket of studies at the end of session. Legislative management will choose which studies they want to look at, and this one may just get not chosen. So I hesitate for that, but at the very least, that would be better than nothing.
The committee did not take immediate action. Dump trucks hauling aggregate material on a North Dakota highway would be required to tarp the material to prevent spillage. Bismarck Republican Representative Lawrence Clemine says far too often the rock, sand, stone, and slate falls out of the truck, damaging roads and windshields. Clemine says he knows firsthand about the damage.
I don't know how many other people on the road have had similar experiences, but I can guess that there are many. The other day, the House passed House Bill 1061 relating to windows impairing the vision of drivers. There's a $20 fine for violation of that law. Should I be subject to a fine if I need to drive around with a broken window for a time until I can get it replaced at my own expense?
Amanda Remensi of North Dakota Motor Carriers Association says the bill does little to stop vehicle damage and adds an extra cost to doing business.
Aggregate is the subbase of road shoulders, or even the main component of gravel roads, which is included in the definition of a highway. Loose aggregate can arrive from many locations as a result of loading, materialing falling outside of the box, a belly dump, or from tires.
North Dakota Highway Patrol Safety and Education Officer Wade Kattermas says enforcement is somewhat difficult unless the trooper observes the material flying off the load. He says during a five-year span between 2017 and 2021, the Highway Patrol has issued 358 citations and 283 warnings. And the North Dakota House has passed a bill that would make sexual reproductive imposition a Class C felony. Republican Representative Kathy Frelick of Devil's Lake carried the bill on the House floor. She says House Bill 1140 would forbid health care providers from inseminating a uterus with reproductive donor material without full consent. She noted the notion of needing a law like this might seem peculiar, however.
A fertility specialist from Indiana inseminated and personally fathered around 90 children. The Attorney General of that state declined to prosecute, as Indiana did not have a law forbidding the conduct. Indiana now has a law. North Dakota does not.
The bill was passed 93-0. The Senate will consider it later. I'm Danielle Webster.
In a world, in a place where the prairies are so wide and frozen, politics gives you a headache. The culture seems so contentious. Finally, here comes Valentine's Day. Like a cozy bungalow on a winter day, all full of warm affection and regard. Perfect for sweethearts and grandparents, little kids and old married couples. And Prairie Public's short and sweet drive. Make a $10 a month or $120 a year contribution, and we will send delicious handmade cocoa truffles in an elegant box to any address you say in the lower 48 states in time for Valentine's Day. Go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Tom Ezern is next with a Plains Folk essay titled, I Claim Authorship.
In December 1916, an old farmer from Candu, Caspar F. Ebner, made a startling declaration in the columns of the Nonpartisan Leader, newspaper of the Nonpartisan League. He claimed to be the author of the Anthem of the Plains, Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim. I claim authorship and copyright to this song and its title, he wrote, other claims of it to the contrary notwithstanding. I like this fellow Ebner, who came to Dakota Territory in 1884 as a bachelor homesteader. At some point, he attended North Dakota Agricultural College, perhaps just the winter short course for farmers, and in 1908 he would write a fond reminiscence in verse of a college friend, Norman B. Powell, and publish it in the NDAC Spectrum. He prospered, married, raised sons, and hired multiple farmhands. He led a Methodist Sunday school. He organized his neighbors in gopher control campaigns. Ebner was an agricultural innovator and a keen observer on the land. He developed a labor-saving method of putting up prairie hay with a binder rather than pitching it loose. He planted dent corn in 1908, long before others dared try it. He made notes on the ground squirrels of Dakota that were used in a bulletin of the U.S. Biological Survey. He obtained cans of pike and trout from the state hatchery and released them in local waters. And he was a poet of sorts, but did he really write Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim? Yeah, I think not. Perhaps he thought everyone else who might have known better had died or forgotten. Perhaps his memories were wishful, or perhaps, and this was common among balladeers on the prairies, in his mind, he came to own the song by learning it, then reworking it, until he convinced himself he was its author. Studying his stanzas, I see Ebner did make his imprint on the song. He incorporates idiosyncratic details and devises a whole new chorus exhibiting defensive Dakota rhetoric. Where the summers have fair weather and the winters quickly pass, here the seasons are of joy and endless chain. When one scents the fragrant posies that are nestled in the grass round the little old sod shanty on the claim. Late in the song, a spasm of evangelical rapture grips Ebner as he envisions himself and all the other persistent denizens of sod shanties elevating from the prairies to be ransomed to the sky. Return, though, to Ebner's chorus, with its reference to a little low sod shanty on the claim. Not a little old sod shanty, but a little low sod shanty. Rhetorical details matter. They can be the DNA by which the lineage of a song can be established. Ebner says he first encountered the song in question in 1880, when he was still in Iowa, in correspondence with one J.J. Nearling at Jamestown. On the James River, of course, locally and familiarly known as the Jim. This background undermines Ebner's claim of authorship, but it also is an important assertion. As detailed in a previous essay, the origins of the song were in Smith County, Kansas, its true author being the poet-printer F. Frank Jerome. Ebner is telling us that in the year of its birth, the song, originally known in Kansas as Little Old Sod Dugout on the Claim, had traveled folk fashion to Dakota, where it was localized and sung as My Little Low Sod Shanty on the Jim. This assertion by Ebner, I believe, and I'm going to proceed from it to describe how, after its migration to Dakota, Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim erupted to become the anthem of the settler society on the plains.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg with Craig Blumenschein and Root Cellar Sue. It's time for Main Street Eats. And for this Main Street Eats, we want to talk about chocolate because, of course, it is our short and sweet member drive. Starting at just $10 a month, you can take home or send to your favorite Valentine in the lower 48 a one-pound box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. It starts with a simple phone call, 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. Craig, you're new to North Dakota. Have you made it to Nicole's yet?
I haven't, but I'm looking forward to trying the truffles.
We're going to have to remedy that.
I think we should talk about chocolate once a week. Not just
I think we should eat chocolate
drive.
Once a week.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What a great way to support public radio and Prairie Public. It's a wonderful, wonderful time to pick up the phone, Ashley. Like you said, give us a call, 800-359-4145, or go to prairiepublic.org The chocolates are the come on, but come on.
Here we go.
Yeah.
It is a 1 pound box that you can send to your sweetie, or maybe you are going to have a little Galentine's Day. You can treat yourself to a box of cocoa truffles. I have sometimes just sent the box to my office, and my husband never even knew about it. Sorry, honey. But they are really delicious. A good, high-quality Belgian chocolate. There's some cream in there. They are dipped in a bittersweet cocoa at the end. Oh, you have this with just a little port or
coffee.
Yeah, they really melt in the mouth. They are a fantastic little treat. They're like a little black dress, too. They go with everything. They really go with Main Street or Away With Words or Morning Edition. Give us a call now, 800-359-4145, or click and join at prairiepublic.org. Sue, you want to talk about chocolate. And this is another thing we talked last week about eggs. Are they good for you? Are they not good for you? And chocolate is another one of those constantly subjected to. It's good for your mental health. It's terrible for you.
Oh, my gosh. But my first question is Galentine?
Yeah, I was wondering about that,
that's if you're celebrating with your friends or you're just having it for yourself.
Okay, what if you're a
guy? What's a boy version of that? Galentine?
Galentine, yeah. Palentine?
Oh, there
for
we
just
go.
Pals?
Neutral, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. That was not on like that episode of Parks and Rec.
Caught me off guard there for a minute. I'm like, what is she?
You've never heard of Galentine's Day?
No,
up.
Was this a Leslie Knope?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, God. And then you left Craig out of the whole thing. Like, he's not a Galentine kind of person.
Heck with that, though. We're going to talk about chocolate once a week from now on. So I'm still a winner.
Okay.
Here.
Well, you know what? I make a chocolate cake that you cannot eat before bedtime because you can't fall asleep because of the caffeine that's in the chocolate. You know? Caffeine has lots of chocolate in it. I'm becoming.
Caffeine has chocolate in it.
I mean,
huh?
Chocolate has. Wait a minute. Did I say that?
You did. We knew what you meant.
Well, my caffeine has chocolate in it, you know? You got to just like stir in a little bit of Starbucks cocoa powder and you have a homemade mocha at
home. There you go.
So, and I don't drink sweet coffee very often. I prefer to have a straight up cup of espresso with a chocolate or a cocoa truffle, which, you know, they aren't that hard to make. They're basically chocolate and cream rolled in a ball and rolled in more chocolate.
But they're even easier to have Nicole make them for
you. It definitely is easier that way. But my kids remember me doing truffles when they were little. I thought that was weird because I totally forgot about that. But back to whether it's good for you or not. Should we vote?
Well, again, it's kind of like we talked about this last week with eggs, and the science is all over the place. But with chocolate, from my perspective, there are different types of chocolate, okay? Dark chocolate, okay. Semi-sweet chocolate, I don't know. And then it gets clouded for me.
Right, and white chocolate, not real chocolate.
Right, yeah. And milk chocolate has got probably more sugar and fat in milk products in it than any of them. So it is the dark chocolate that they say is, like
is
really,
kind of
really good for you. And I love
and the
dark
stuff that
chocolate
is as left alone as possible, right?
Right.
I mean, not straight off the tree because that's way too bitter and obviously doesn't grow around here. But typically, if you can kind of get minimally processed, not too much sugar added.
Right. And it should have 70 to 85% cocoa content. You know, like when I buy it for baking, I always go and look to see what the content is of the actual cocoa, cacao or whatever.
Cacao,
what is it?
Yeah.
You're so good with foreign languages. I just am not. there are several good quality chocolates in the United States, but I had a British sister-in-law that she said it just doesn't compare to the chocolates that you can get over in Europe.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I feel
right
a little
about that.
Slighted there. So,
Well, going back to the health thing, I do have a cookbook that has recipes that follow the hormone cycle for a woman. So four different phases of the menstrual cycle, four different hormonal cycles. And one of them goes into detail about, you know, why you're craving chocolate at certain times and says that dark cocoa has actually a lot of magnesium. And that helps your body to fight with stress. And that's why you want to reach for that Hershey's bar when you're stressed out. But perhaps if you can replace it with something a little bit higher quality.
Right, and that's actually true. I like in a 100-gram bar of dark chocolate with the high cocoa amount, there's actually 11 grams of fiber in there, but over 50% of that is your daily required magnesium. And so, yeah, I can see that, although I never really put that in together with chocolate because what's wrong with eating chocolate anytime you're stressed?
I'm just saying, if you want the science behind that.
Right. And so there's copper in there. There's manganese. There's iron. There's 66% of that 100-gram bar of chocolate has iron in it, which that's, you know, like I always have low blood pressure and low iron in my blood. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to have to really start eating more dark chocolate, apparently.
Mm, there you go.
It has potassium, phosphorus, zinc, selenium. The reason I think, part of the reason is that, you know, for those of us that like bitter, which I read another article about how we're so accustomed to sweet in this country, mm-hmm. that bitter isn't even on our radar anymore. As in, we're going to be talking about dandelions in a couple months, you know, like bitter greens, bitter chocolate, those kinds of flavors. Our kids aren't getting any of that when they're young, and so they find it to be, like, offensive when they're older. I'm the person who digs all the little dark chocolate candy bars out of those packages of mixed varieties there. But it has less sugar in it than, of course, the milk chocolate does. And chocolate chips, now I actually buy the dark chocolate chips because I think they just make those cookies so much better.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Yep, and lots of walnuts.
Semi-sweet chocolate chips is what's always on my list when I go shopping for my wife. Never dark chocolate.
Chips. Absolutely. You got to get dark chocolate. And like Ashley said earlier, you can actually get white chocolate chips, but there's no such thing.
What is white chocolate, honestly?
That is
it
a good
question.
It should
be outlawed. The legislature's in session. Yeah, it's not the same. It's not the same.
I'm going to have to look into that. I don't know exactly what the ingredients are, but there's a lot of words you can't pronounce in white chocolate, that's for sure.
I always wondered just basically what makes that chocolate white? What is up with that?
The lack of anything resembling cocoa. But I'm going to confess this. Have you ever had snowman poop?
I can confess no.
I love snowman poop. It's those not good to eat plain puffy popcorn things without the hull.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
they're extruded.
Yeah.
And then you melt white chocolate and pour it over the top.
That's what it's called?
Snowman poop, yep. And my granddaughter, Lucy, she said, "Oh, Grandma, this just has the right amount of sweet and salt to it, doesn't it?" And I'm like, "You're 10 years old. That was, like, profound."
What's this stuff called in Arizona, though? That's my question.
Yeah. Well, maybe they – let's see. What else – I don't know. We'll go past that, huh? Doofta. Okay, so back to chocolate.
Yeah, what should you look for on the package to know the ingredients if you're getting a high-quality chocolate?
Well, I'll tell you what. If it has more than two ingredients or three ingredients, then I would put it back on the shelf because basically it's got a little sweetener in it. And then it has the cocoa, which you've seen all the chocolate movies, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, where she's grinding the chocolate, mm-hmm. the one with Johnny Depp in it.
Yeah, I was mostly watching Johnny Depp, but sure.
But I was watching her crunch up the chocolate, the cocoa beans to make the chocolate. Then they add, do they add butter to that, you know, like to make it creamy?
Cocoa butter, right?
Yeah, so that's what you want to look for, actually, is that cocoa content. And then, you know me, I have these issues with words I can't pronounce on labels. So anytime you buy something in the grocery store, the fewer ingredients it has means it's closer to the farm. And so that's one of the things that I would recommend if you're looking to do clean eating this year. Oh, yeah, we forgot. Oh, it's not January anymore, so we're off the hook with Wellness Healthy Month, right? So eat all the chocolate you want, especially if you can get a box of truffles.
And you can get that by picking up the phone and calling 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. It is our short and sweet member drive. Short because it is only Wednesday through Saturday. Sweet because our thank you gift is a 1 pound box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry, sent to anywhere in the lower 48 in time for Valentine's Day or Galentine's Day if you're into it.
I thought we settled on Palentine's
or Palentine's Day. Yeah. Man, there's so many.
Gender neutral. Or
Palentine's Day. We should do a Palentine's Day. All right. But whatever your reason for celebrating chocolate and the programming that you hear day in and day out on Prairie Public, call now in support, 800-359-4145, or click and join at prairiepublic.org. $10 a month is your first box. After that, it can be $15 a month for two boxes. It goes up from there. We have one guy every year who gets a bunch of cocoa truffles for his staff, and I think we end up sending 10 boxes or so out.
Did you give him my address?
Do you work for this guy?
Well,
no, you work for yourself.
It's not JC. We'll end it right there.
Oh, no.
All right. Sue, thank you.
Oh, thank you. And happy Palentine's Day to both of you.
Out of way, Sue. Thank you very much.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 2nd. Over the years, myriad allegations of bad acts by candidates in elections have surfaced in North Dakota, some serious, others less so. For over a century, state laws have sought to clamp down on candidate misconduct. On this date in 1912, the Bismarck Tribune reminded voters that the new Corrupt Practice Act of 1911 would be in effect during a city bond election just days away. The Tribune noted that there would be no transport for voters from around town to the polls, as in years past. The newspaper said voters must walk. There would be no electioneering on Election Day, nor any election cigars or drinks. Quoth the Tribune, perish the thought. Over the years, myriad allegations have surfaced in connection with North Dakota's Corrupt Practices Act, which was revised in 1981. Here's a sampling. In 1914, a Bowman County judge contested his election loss, accusing his opponent of bribing voters by saying he would take less pay if elected. The case resulted in the first disqualification of a candidate under the Corrupt Practice Act, and it allowed the judge to retain his seat. In 1965, several state senators denounced pressure and intimidation from lobbyists related to legislation regarding the territories of rural electrification cooperatives. One senator alleged veiled threats to oppose completely unrelated legislation and retaliation against lawmakers who were business owners. In another episode that played out from 1969 to 1975, state and federal court cases involved several prominent North Dakota Democrats accused of embezzling Minot Bank funds for political purposes. It included state lawmakers, a former congressman, and other party leaders who were also bank executives and stockholders. The cases ended with dismissed charges or plea deals and fines. In 1982, Democrats cried foul after a Republican state lawmaker distributed more than 500 cartons of eggs in residential areas in Towner County the evening before the general election, which he narrowly won. The carton said, "Experience counts." The lawmaker said he got the idea from Democrats who had given out pumpkins and watermelons in previous elections. The Towner County state's attorney investigated and found no wrongdoing. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
A couple of minutes left in today's Main Street to vote for a show like Main Street with your show of support. Give us a call now at 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. And what do I mean when I say voting? I mean you are showing that you care about programming like this when you call in during a member drive. Maybe you're here for the weekend programming like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Away with Words, or you love the news programs all day, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and of course the news staff, Todd, Danielle, Dave, and Katie. But of course, we hope that what you really love is Main Street. And if nothing else, you're here to love chocolate, and you can get a one-pound box of cocoa truffles when you call 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. An especially sweet day for you to become a member. With your investment, you get this one-pound box of cocoa truffles to you or your Valentine. Give us a call now at 800-359-4145 or join online at prairiepublic.org.
Ashley, we really do hope that people call right now or go online right now and pledge their support during Main Street. You know, Prairie Public is a rare thing in our country.
Yes.
It's one of the few statewide networks that covers nearly every corner of the state that it serves. And of course, North Dakota is not a small state.
Nope.
You have charged me, Ashley, with getting out and about. But we already do that in other ways for our station. I'll get to do it by meeting people from everywhere. It takes 17 transmitters for us to get our signal across our state. Stations and translators in Bowman, Hettinger, Devil's Lake, Jamestown, Dickinson, and Beach make sure that our coverage of local issues is heard by everyone, and our stories that are here on Main Street are heard by everyone as well. In 2022, we added another Western reporter to ensure more news stories were being told across our state. So regardless of which corner of North Dakota you are in, take a moment. Give us a call, 800-359-4145. Make this happen. Pledge your gift of support.
And Craig, as you are going out and meeting people, when you do get a chance to leave the studio and meet the people of North Dakota face to face, you know, you've heard of that game, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, where you can tie people and until they've met Kevin Bacon. Well, in North Dakota, I think you'll find it's a lot easier to be friendly with someone, and it might be 1 or 2 degrees. And, you know, the reason we call the show Main Street is that great quote that North Dakota is a series of towns connected by one long Main Street. This is a conversation that connects the people of North Dakota with the content that we frankly think they deserve to hear. It feeds your intelligence and your curiosity. You are supporting that now when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. Coming up tomorrow on the show, how can our pets teach us about ourselves? We visit with an author who wrote a book called No Ordinary Cats, as she tells the story of her life from the perspective of her cats. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.